Good morning or afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Monday, May 20th. I'm Alan Shartok. Support for the Medical Monday comes from Saratoga OBGYN at Myrtle Street and the new physician midwife pregnancy care model at Saratoga Hospital. SaratogaHospital.org for more information. Joining us this afternoon for Medical Monday is Dr. Richard Holub of the Neurological Associates of Albany. He's here to answer your questions about Alzheimer's disease treatment and research. A lot of calls coming, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Holub, your calls, all coming up on the Vox Pop right after this news. Hello once again and welcome back to Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss Alzheimer's disease treatment and research is Dr. Richard Holub of the Neurological Associates of Albany. Dr. Holub graduated from Rutgers University and received his medical degree from Georgetown University. He's a member of the American Academy of Neurology. Dr. Holub has been engaged in Alzheimer's research for more than 30 years and has contributed to the development of all 5 drugs approved by the FDA to treat the disease. Dr. Holub, it's always a pleasure to welcome you back here. Your subject is so incredibly and critically important.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you've always been good to us by coming. The number to call, everybody, is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We really want to hear from you. I know that an awful lot of people are suffering from this disease. Doctor, what are your chances of getting some form of Alzheimer's after the age, let's say, of 60 or 70?
Generally, we target the age of 65. To be sure, people can get Alzheimer's disease very young, but it increases the frequency increases with increasing age. And by the time we're 85, about 50% of us have the disease, and the other 50% are taking care of us.
Isn't that interesting? We know that a lot of people are getting it. Are we equipped to handle the rush?
No. The increase in prevalence of the disease, the aging of the population, the increased appearance of it is something that will reach a point perhaps by 2050 that it will sink the economic ship and it may sink us financially. So we have to find a cure. There's no doubt about it.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you the question I ask you every time you're here. Will we find a cure?
I'm now certain that we will find a cure.
What makes you so certain?
Well, the science is growing exponentially as it relates to Alzheimer's disease. And while there are many, many steps and many, many contributors to the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease, our understanding of these is increasing to such a degree that even though there are many missing pieces, it seems like a large puzzle that you can now see that you're going to finish it.
That's great. Well, as we often say around here, from your lips to God's ear, that's terrific. We always have caller number one, as always, Jim from Matamoros. Okay, Jim, keep your question short. Go ahead.
How do you differentiate Alzheimer's from other forms of dementia?
Well, right now, it's principally done clinically. Alzheimer's disease affects people, as we said, of increasing age. And there's a particular sequence that's very common. First, patients will develop problems with recent memory and recall. They might have repetitive questions. They might have word-finding difficulties. They might be misplacing items. And later, this may go on to interrupt the function of other brain domains that may have, for instance, be important in check paying, bill writing, called executive functioning, or may be involved in understanding your sense of direction, geographic sense, or another brain domain that may relate to being able to identify things that you see right in front of you. And the sequence of this evolution has a certain pattern in Alzheimer's disease that's different in other diseases. It can be helped by biomarkers, which aren't yet commonly available. We do have an Alzheimer's amyloid scan, which is wonderful. It costs $7,000. Insurance doesn't pay.
And what is an amyloid again?
Amyloid. Amyloid is a molecule. 42 amino acids is the species that we're most concerned about. And it tends to aggregate to itself and form something called little groups called oligomers. And they interrupt the synaptic functioning, the jumping of the electrical impulse from one nerve to another, and is involved in the initiation of the process of Alzheimer's disease. A lot more to say about that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that very good answer. Let's see here.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks again. All right. And now we're going to go to George in Woodstock. George in Woodstock, you're on.
How are you?
Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi. Can barely hear you, but my question was about lion's mane mushrooms and if you could talk a little bit about the advances that are being found with Alzheimer's and some mushrooms such as lion's mane. Instead of spending $7,000 on a scan or more FDA drugs, what about things that grow in nature?
To be sure, many of the important medications that we've discovered and many of the links to long and healthy life have been tied to a nutritional values and understandings and patterns. And we always look to those populations that age gracefully and long. And what do they do? And, you know, I'll eat what they eat, right? However, it's not a line of research that I've been personally involved with. And I cannot comment on mushrooms. But to be sure, there's a lot of research going into foodstuffs, natural foodstuffs. Yes.
Thank you. All right. That doctor is always articulate. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Brian in Woodstock. Brian, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call, doctors. I'm wondering if you could comment on Korsakoff syndrome, talk a little bit about that, and also if there is any treatment for it. And what to do about somebody who has it.
Korsakoff syndrome begins usually, but not always, at least in the past, in relationship to the fact that people become thiamine deficient, usually by drinking too much alcohol and getting their calories, but not vitamins through alcohol. And that alcohol deficiency, that alcohol leads to a thiamine deficiency. And there's an area in the circuitry of the brain called the median nucleus of the thalamus that does not function without thiamine. And without thiamine, you'll have a deficit in recent memory and recall. We're beginning to see this now in people who have had bariatric surgery, gastric bypass surgery, where they may not be properly vitamin replaced. And it often begins with an acute change, an acute confusional delirium-like state, which is called Wernicke's encephalopathy, and then over time it leads to a more chronic condition called Korsakoff psychosis. Now, Korsakoff psychosis has a pure memory impairment, a pure recent memory impairment. You can walk in the room to a patient in the pure case and say, hello, my name is such and such, walk out, walk in again, and they will forget that you've been there. On a terrible, tragic side, you could go in and you say, I have to report that things are not the same since your mother died, and they may not know that their mother died because they have a retrospective memory impairment that may go back a number of years, and they'll go through the whole mourning situation. You can walk out the room, walk back in, and say your mother died, and they'll go through the same thing once again.
Wow.
It's a pure memory impairment, but over time, about a third of the people will recover if they receive proper nutrition. About
a third. Thiamine?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And we can make it worse in the emergency room. If somebody comes in who's nutritionally deprived, maybe they're unconscious, they've been in a car accident, and we hook them up to an IV, the little bit of thiamine left in their blood, we can drive into their cells and drop their thiamine level to zero and induce the syndrome. So in the emergency room with these unconscious patients, we like to put 100 milligrams of thiamine in each IV bottle to prevent such.
Isn't that interesting? Well, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. All right, we're going to take a very short break. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You got us started, Doc. And then when we come back, we'll go to Lisa in Schenectady. We are back with Dr. Richard Holb of the Neurological Associates of Albany, the expert in our area on Alzheimer's disease. Before we go to Lisa, who I promised we would go to, I wanted to ask you, everybody's talking amyloids. What's that all about?
Beta amyloid is a protein that seems to be involved in the initiation of the disease called Alzheimer's disease. And we used to think that it was this wear and tear catabolic or breakdown product, gunk that would aggregate and accumulate and initiate the disease. And it likely does initiate the disease. And all the genetic changes that occur in various families that predispose to Alzheimer's disease affect amyloid. However, recent research over the past few years has demonstrated that amyloid actually belongs to the primitive immune system. And the primitive immune system is called the innate immune system. It's different than the modern immune system, which we call the adaptive immune system. And it likely is what we call a antimicrobial peptide. It fights bacteria and infection, and its job is to aggregate and accumulate around bacteria and enveloped viruses and even some cancer cells. So it's got a positive function. It's just not an unnecessary compound. And it probably is triggered by silent infections that we get through our lifetime. It's a molecule that's complex, has some positive functions in the body, has been around since we were swimming in the ancient seas 400 million years ago. They've demonstrated amyloid was then, and anything that's conserved through nature over 400 million years has a purpose.
And is it the key?
It's probably the key to the initiation of the disease. We haven't been able to find attacking it yet as a key to the cure of the disease, but we will find a cure to this disease.
So there was a point at which there was great hope for this, and they thought they had it because of the amyloids, but we didn't.
At least the research to date has been failure after failure. Amyloid has a series of what we call different forms called species, and it goes through many, many adaptive changes, maybe 7 or 8 changes until it becomes an amyloid plaque. And at first we thought, well, maybe we were attacking the wrong species. We were hitting it at a single molecule or at the plaque. And then we said, well, we're giving it too late. We have to give it earlier and earlier. It's possible that we will find, there may be even one in clinical trial now, that might hit the right species in the right population early enough in the disease, but it's a very narrow target. We'd like a broader target. We think we're going to get one. We're going to cure this disease.
Great. And over to Lisa in Schenectady. Lisa, you're on.
Hi. Like to ask if aluminum cookware and aluminum foil contribute to Alzheimer's.
No.
Thank you.
First of all, I can tell you that aluminum is very toxic to biologic systems. It's highly reactive, and it's worrisome. And aluminum does get into food. So when you cook your spaghetti sauce and you decide to put it back in the refrigerator and you put your aluminum foil over it, the next day you take that aluminum foil and you hold it up to the light, you'll see it's thinned where it made contact with the spaghetti sauce. And that aluminum yes. got into the spaghetti sauce, and when you eat it, it gets into you. And not only does it get into you, it gets into your brain. And it sits in the brain in the area of the white matter, and likely doesn't cause any damage to memory and cognition, and is not related to Alzheimer's disease. However, the kind of aluminum that we can't do anything about, that in the air through pollution, comes up through the nasal epithelium and does get into the memory areas of the brain and might aggravate Alzheimer's disease. And there's very little we can do about that.
Do we test for aluminum?
No.
Should we?
Yeah, good point.
We should test for aluminum if we had an answer to eliminating it as a problem.
Well, one wonders, right, Lisa, whether or not there's a higher aluminum count in some points of the parts of the country than others.
Oh, absolutely. It's very clear. In an unrelated situation, if you look at the breast cancer map of New York State, you'll see that some counties are overwhelmed with breast cancer and others have very little. Sure. Surely environmental factors play a big role.
Lisa, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. Okay, and a very good question. Let's go to Kathy in Amherst. Kathy in Amherst.
Hello?
Hi, Kathy. I'm glad you're calling from Amherst. I love Amherst.
Oh, thank you. So listen, I heard your response around the dementia-Alzheimer's differentiation, but I don't really understand the difference in the clinical development of non-Alzheimer's dementia as opposed to Alzheimer's dementia. I'm not clear on that answer still.
Join the club. In any case, there's a particular common sequence of the evolution of symptoms in patients who develop Alzheimer's disease. Many of the same symptoms can occur in people who develop other dementias, like Lewy body dementia or frontotemporal dementia or cortical basal degeneration. However, the sequencing and the evolution of their symptoms differs. This has led to neurologists having a job. So it's something that we work out in our patients. But it's difficult to, in less than an hour, give you a straight answer. Just to say that there are a series of symptoms. They all look the same, but the method in which they, the pattern in which they evolve is different. And it really does give you a clear picture as a neurologist practicing in this area what the most likely diagnosis is.
But you know, Kathy, you raise a very interesting point, and that is there's a social aspect to this, too. I can't tell you how many people don't want their parents to have had Alzheimer's. So they say it really wasn't Alzheimer's. We think it was dementia, as if dementia is better than Alzheimer's. Is it?
Dementia is lousy, whether it's due to Alzheimer's disease or whether dementia is due to head injury or meningitis or any other cause. It's a lousy problem.
Kathy, do you ever come back here?
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Thanks, Kathy. Telephone number here is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in now are excellent. All you have to do is call it 1-800-348-2551. Now to Michael in West Ghent. Michael, you're on.
Hi there. Is there any correlation between the taking of statins and brain health and/or Alzheimer's? And would you recommend medium chain triglycerides, MCT oils, and/or coconut oils or coconut milk for brain health?
No.
That was a fast answer. Go ahead.
No to any of it. There's been a movement in Alzheimer's disease epidemiology research away from single agent replacements. Even if you take a handful of different single agents, and the focus has mainly been on eating a well-balanced, preferably Mediterranean-like diet where meat is more of a garnish, where you have a diet rich in vegetables and fruits, with at times an emphasis on dark-skinned vegetables and fruits, where there are many vitamins and nutrients that we know about, and there's still many that we don't know about yet. And those are the folks who do the best in that regard. There was a little bit more to your question, but I can't remember.
But how do we come to that? And let me ask you the follow-up question on that. Do we epidemiologically look at what people eat and then say who gets Alzheimer's and who doesn't?
Yeah. First of all, we look at populations around the globe and look at their cognitive health.
Right.
And we study that. And then from that, we may derive other more targeted research programs. But none of the things that you mention have scientific, what we would call class one data to support them. Yes, we're researching it. Yes, it's a big part of the Alzheimer's Disease International Conference every year. It'll occur again in July this year in Los Angeles. And there's lots of discussion about diet, but we don't have any specific, particularly coconut oil has been disproven as being beneficial in a population of people. I can't say it's bad. I don't think so. And maybe there's somebody who benefits, but as a general population rule, it doesn't meet the standard.
Michael, thank you. Okay, let's go to Zach in Lee, Massachusetts. Zach, your turn.
Hi. Yeah, my question is: is there very early signs of Alzheimer's?
So the question is: what are the earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease? I would say that the earliest signs are a decrease in recent memory and recall, comparing the person to the person. So I can only compare an individual in front of me to that same individual. Usually you need another family member who knows that person well, and the patient themselves, to how are you doing with a recent memory and recall? Are you asking repetitive questions? Are you misplacing items? Are you having trouble with word finding? We allow people not to be very good at name recollection and recall. That seems to be more normal aging. So those would be among the earliest signs, and plus maybe one other thing, maybe some difficulties with attention and focus when it comes to your checkbook or your calendar, or difficulties with your sense of direction, where you really have to stretch now to think of how you're going to get from here to Colony Center, or that sort of thing, where in the past it may have been automatic. So recent memory and recall and maybe one other issue might represent early signs. Make sure there isn't a new depression going on. Make sure there isn't a new medical problem. Make sure you're not having issues with your adult children or kids, that there isn't something psychosocial, an issue, an argument with your boss, that sort of thing.
So does it present in different ways for different people? You know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Does it present in different ways in different people? The vast majority of people present the way that I indicated. Mm-hmm. Some people can develop Alzheimer's disease in other ways. For instance, they might start with executive dysfunction, where they're having trouble with their bill paying or their planning and organization. It's not common, but it can happen. Some people have, it begins with difficulties with their vision, where even though their eyes test out well and the connections to the back of the brain where it enters the brain work out well, when that visual information is forwarded in the brain to identify things, it may not identify them, may not see them. So things that are right in front of you, you may not see, and it's a hazard with driving, et cetera. And they may cognitively, out-talk their doctor, but they'll have that issue early on.
Zach, anything else?
No, I think you answered my question. By your answer, I might be in trouble.
And by the way, Zach, so might we all. Thank you.
Yes.
Thanks, Zach. All right. And now on to, let's see, Harold in Poughkeepsie. Harold, your turn. Go.
Wow. Hello.
Go ahead, Al.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing today? Hello. I've noticed, I've been tracking this a little bit over the last year or two. Today, as an example, I couldn't even recall the term chainsaw at Home Depot. And I've gone from being a person who was in management, an entrepreneur. My family used to always try to get me to get on Jeopardy. And I'm wondering if there is something I could do to counteract it. At one point, I did a little bit of community theater because I kind of felt this, and this was 10 years ago. When I felt it coming on, did a few plays and stuff. And it seems to be slowly progressing. Is there anything I can do to stop the progression or turn it around?
Well, right now, some of the things that I mentioned earlier, engaging your mind in activities that are language related. I like the idea of doing the acting and getting involved. Some people feel learning a foreign language or relearning a foreign language and priming that part of the brain might be helpful. And that's the left side of the brain, the language brain. The right side of the brain, which is arts, crafts, music, hobbies, might do pretty well for acting as well. The idea of exercise is really very, very important. Not only does exercise increase neurotrophic factors in the brain, but there also are products secreted by muscles that gain access to the brain that help us think better. So we've mainly looked at walking. But any exercise is important, and although aerobic exercise is better than non-aerobic exercise, house cleaning, yard work, just walking,
gardening,
yeah, it's all it all is important, and things to think about. One of the issues with your question is that there is an evolving understanding of is there a difference between normal aging and Alzheimer's disease? And at this point, and it may change by next year if I come back, at this point, it's thought that normal aging is called PART, or primary age-related tauopathy. And in PART, normal aging, the first things that happen are the exact same first things that happen in Alzheimer's disease. Some difficulties with word finding and difficulties with minor memory glitches. And some people have it more than others. So it's a complete overlap with Alzheimer's disease, which is why with Alzheimer's disease, you're looking for something additional in your thinking or your cognition to be off.
Because I've gone from being a minister who can recall scriptures, and now I have trouble kind of getting them back into my head.
Well, practice, and if you're concerned, see your neurologist.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Harold. Okay, and now let's see here. We'll go to Nathan in Rotterdam. Nathan in Rotterdam. And he's on 6. Okay.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Okay, go.
Hi.
On, Nathan.
I just wanted to see if you guys were aware that there was some promising research coming out of Siena College that shows the use of turmeric actually helps prevent dementia in Alzheimer's.
I know that
this was like 5 years ago, so I'm not sure if that's part of the research that failed. But
those kinds of research programs are interesting to whet the appetites and to go further. It never rose to the level of what we call class one research, which is equal to things like the law of gravity that are absolute certainties. So it's at a much lower level, and it's not something that's officially recommended.
So in other words,
okay, thank you.
In other words, no. Thanks, Nathan. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a very short break. Boy, this program is going fast. and we'll be back in just a moment. We are back, and we're talking to the wonderful Richard Holub, who is a neurologist and from Neurological Associates of Albany. Doctor, let's take some more calls. Let's go to Judy in Poughkeepsie. Judy in Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Hi there. I'd like to know if there is research about shock treatments and loss of memory, and perhaps loss of memory leading to Alzheimer's.
Shock treatments, electroconvulsive therapy, has been associated in some cases. There can be damage to recent memory and recall that is long-lasting. One of the goals of that therapy is to reduce your recent memory and recall so you can forget your pain and suffering. So in part, it's an efficacy product of the treatment, but you want it such that your recent memory comes back. Now, in the past, when we would do ECT therapy back in the 1960s, shock both sides of the brain and give a more significant generalized convulsion. And although effective, more effective than most of the medications we use for major depressive disorder, there was a higher degree of occasional people with cognitive loss. Now, with electroconvulsive therapy, the psychiatrist only will shock one side of the brain, usually the right side of the brain, the non-language brain, and this as a complication is very rare. Certainly, if you have memory and cognitive difficulties and later get Alzheimer's disease, it's going to be amplified by a pre-existing condition, but as a cause of Alzheimer's, no.
Okay, Judy?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. 1-800-348-2551. I'm waiting for your call. 1-800-348-2551. And Alan in Glenmont. Okay, Alan, you're on.
Hi. Hello. Hi. I was wondering whether social isolation of an older person has any relation to dementia or Alzheimer's. My mother-in-law lost her 65-year partner about 8 or 9 years ago, and then a few years later stopped doing everything. She wouldn't do the exercise she was doing. She just really took herself away from the church and just stayed home, and we always say, was this something that was caused by her lack of social prowess? And we're wondering whether that has anything to do with it.
It's certainly not helpful. We don't know the answer to that in any given person, but we do know that the things that I've mentioned, like regular exercise, left language brain activity, right brain arts, crafts, music activity, and your issue that you brought up, socialization, all of these things increase neurotrophic protective factors in the brain. We're social animals. We don't do well in social isolation. We feed on each other in our interactions, and they enrich our lives and they enrich our brain. So there probably is a reduction in those substances that keep the brain healthy, young and active. And I'm always encouraging people to get out and do something.
Thanks, Alan.
Right. Very good. Thanks. You so much.
Right. Bye. We'll go now to Daniel in Schuylerville. Daniel in Schuylerville, you're on. Go ahead, Daniel.
Hi. My question, I think you may have touched around this before. The question is, would learning to read music help prevent Alzheimer's?
Yes.
it's an interesting point. It's a very interesting point.
Engaging, reading music is wonderful. First of all, you're essentially learning a new language, mm-hmm. And that engages the left brain. But you're also interacting with the right brain, which is where a lot of our musicality comes from. So learning to read music is a wonderful addition to brain health. If it wasn't so hard, we'd recommend it for everyone.
Well, it's an interesting point. You know, I'm a B-flat trumpet player, but I often have to read over somebody's shoulder who's playing the piano, and that's C. So you have to stay one measure ahead to transpose from C to B-flat. That's not easy, and you make a good point.
No, it's a wonderful way to engage the mind and keep those synapses snapping.
Thank you, Daniel. All right, and now on to... Adolfo in Ellenville, New York. Adolfo, your turn. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. My mother had Alzheimer's, and I'd like to know what the hereditary factors are in Alzheimer's. With my mother, my father died, and my mother was very lonely, didn't have any friends for several years, and then she developed Alzheimer's.
Well, we generally divide people into three groups. Those with genetic Alzheimer's disease, which is rare, and you'll probably never meet anybody or any family who ever has that. It often occurs in people who are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. It's common. There's a large cohort of such patients in a family in Colombia, South America, that's being studied currently. However, so that group is not you. There's another group of people who have Alzheimer's disease related and amplified by certain risk factors, which are genetic. They are mild, but they build up, and some people may have an increased risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. A risk factor is not genetically getting the disease. And in people with risk factors, more than anybody else, if they happen to know they have one, doing the things that I've mentioned, I'm going to say it again just so we don't forget, regular exercise, keeping left language brain busy, the right brain, arts, crafts, music, hobbies, and socialization, Mediterranean diet. Those things, if you have risk factors, are the things you should engage in. And who would ever argue? Because they're good and healthful things that that your grandmother probably would have told you to do anyway.
Thank you very much, Adolfo. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I look forward to hearing from you. And now on to Carolyn in Red Hook. Carolyn?
Oh, hi, you guys. My question has to do with the medications that are out there. I've had at least one friend who was on medication for a long time, and I'm wondering if what's out there now and whether the older ones or newer meds, if there are effective at all in helping slow things down in terms of Alzheimer's.
The answer is yes. First of all, there is a percentage of doctors who are well published, write textbooks in this area, who say the current medications don't work. That's wrong. They do work. It's been proven by multiple studies, and there is a huge recent article in one of our journals going over this from A to Z, over a million pages, demonstrating that these drugs are disease modifying. They make a difference. The problem is that they're very weak. They're weak, but they're disease-modifying. They make a difference in a lifetime. You very rarely, only two or three times a year, will I give one of the current medications to a patient, and they'll come back and say, I'm better. We don't tell the patients to look for better. We say, look for stabilizing, plateauing, or slowing progression. And it does that. It does that over a lifetime. And if these have been prescribed, one should stay on them and not get off.
Thanks, Carolyn. Okay, now on to Nancy in Albany. Nancy in Albany, you're on. Nancy.
All right, stabilizing.
Hello. Hello, Nancy.
Hello. Okay.
Well, look, you've got to turn your radio off and get on the phone. Go ahead.
I just turned my radio off. My name is Franny. I'm from Gilderland.
Okay.
And I have a comment basically about the fact that you can't call into a radio show and ask someone on the phone to match your symptoms to a disease. My problem goes with people who do this all the time, but never bother doing any follow-up.
Thank you, Nancy. Okay, let's go to Joyce in Troy. Joyce in Troy. Go ahead, Joyce.
Yes. I'm calling about my husband. He had dementia. He had a PhD in physics and taught here in Troy locally. He walked to and from work every day. He read prolifically. He worked in the garden. He had a good diet. Loved classical music. It seems to me when I listen to what doctors have to say about Alzheimer's, he did everything. His lifestyle would suggest he wouldn't become a victim of white matter disease, which was his form of dementia, that he, you know, I had to put him in a nursing home. Could he have done anything to have avoided all that?
I don't think so. In his particular case, he had what's called a leukodystrophy. They're very rare. I'd say we see maybe one case a year in the Capital District. Very rare. They look a lot like Alzheimer's disease. It is a progressive neurodegenerative group of conditions. Usually there's a genetic variant that predisposes you to late onset symptoms. There are other variants that can occur in childhood or adolescence, young adulthood. But in those affecting older folks, we see about a case a year in the Capital Region. And there's very little that we know about that we can do for those right now. But it raises a point that you can do everything right and still lose. And that has to do, in likelihood, with the interactions of beta amyloid and likely related to certain things that happen through life, like our relationship to certain infections that we get that may spur the spawning of more and more beta amyloid and cause the disease process in people who are doing everything right. And it may explain some of the differences we see in identical twin pairs where one person will have the condition and the other does not, even if they both do the same thing.
His doctor told me he had white matter disease.
Yeah, that it's white in medical terms is leuko. And dystrophy is deterioration. It would be called a leukodystrophy.
Okay, thank you, Joyce. Okay, and now on to, Barbara in Stone Ridge. All right, Barbara, you're on.
Yes, 10 years ago, in 2009, I was diagnosed with calcification in the cerebral artery. And I was put on Plavix or clopidogrel. And I've been reading about omega-3 fish oils and just wondering if to go the natural way, if I'm safe to switch from a pharmaceutical to a fish oil.
That's a question for your doctor.
My doctor. He never asked me to have a follow-up years later to see if it's gotten worse or the same. I mean, am I just... do I want to know if there's nothing that can be done?
I think that there are risks and benefits to being on a medication for a protracted period. There was a reason for them putting you on a blood thinner like Plavix. And I think if it's uncertain now and you don't feel you're getting the right answer, then see a subspecialist, maybe a stroke specialist, et cetera. You can even ask your doctor to recommend one that you're concerned about the fact that you're still on the drug and you'd like to look into it further. I'm sure they'll be happy with that.
Okay. Thanks,
Barbara. Okay, 1-800-348-2551. We've got time for one or two more. Let's go to Mike in Scotia. Mike, you're on.
Hello.
Hello, Mike.
I heard a report within the last month, but I don't know where it came from, that there are some people with Lyme disease that are inappropriately being diagnosed as Alzheimer's patients. Is there any overlap like that where there's a problem distinguishing?
Central nervous system Lyme disease can cause memory and cognitive difficulties. We test every single new patient for Lyme, whether they have any symptoms or not. Where we get into the murky territory is when the testing is negative and people believe they still have Lyme disease. And we get into an area which might be called the art of medicine, where some physicians believe that the current testing is insufficient, and they might ascribe somebody's symptoms to that. But in terms of strict current modern medicine class one data, we test every patient, and if they have it, we treat them.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, on to Paul in Lanesboro. Paul in Lanesboro, you're on. Hey, Paul.
Hello. Are you there?
We're here. Are you there?
Oh, well, that's a good question. I'm here or there.
That is a good question. Paul, have you turned your radio off?
All right, we're going to do that. Turn the radio off. We did that. Okay. Sorry,
yeah.
Can you hear me now?
By the way, that's rule number one. When you're participating in the program, everybody should just turn their radios off because there's a delay between what's on the radio and what's on your phone. So you got to be doing it on the phone. But go ahead, Paul. You're on.
Now, can I remember what you just said?
That's very funny. Go ahead.
All right. Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, I got it.
I live in Lanesboro, Massachusetts, and I'm in a study now. With a device that is supposedly, and I suppose it does, developed by a lady at MIT, Professor Tsai, and another gentleman whose name escapes me. And it has to do with, according to what I've read, of course, a little bit, and I'm no genius in any field, never mind this. And it's about gamma stimulation therapy. I wear glasses across my eyes that with strobe lights is what I was told, and earphones that go click, click, click in your ears. And I'm 67 years old, and I have already been diagnosed with Alzheimer's too. I'm just wondering what the good doctor thinks about that particular sort of thing.
I'm not sure that I entirely can follow what she's doing. Devices in Alzheimer's disease are interesting, but it's very early time. I would say this is not a study that's leading to class one data, but an exploratory study. The time will come when devices will play a role, but not now. And that's about all that I can say about it. And good luck with it.
Good luck to you.
Just if you don't mind one thing, the study is done by the Boston Memory Clinic. And they're using an apparatus that is, I guess, doctored size based on her thing. So it is, you're right, it is a study, a company called Cognito in Cambridge, Massachusetts. All right.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Really do. All right. And so that's it. We are out of time. And I want to thank Dr. Richard Holub of the Neurological Associates of Albany, in case you want to get in touch with them, Neurological Associates of Albany, for being with us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Gomez Neurology, Albany, New York, medical neurologist offering scrambler pain therapy and FDA-cleared, non-invasive, and non-drug pain relief therapy. GomezNeurology.com for information. Thanks to our engineer, and he's a good one, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowicz for answering the phone. Our producer's Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Shartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Stay tuned now for the Media Project.